Okay. Second half home stretch. We'll try to pick up the pace a little bit here. Okay, so this helps you if you're on Linux, Mac, or Windows. So this is all this Intel hardware motherboard stuff. So you may or may not know this, but the PC business is fairly commoditized, and the way it's been commoditized is not just the CPU that comes from Intel, it's the entire motherboard design. So they own not only the CPU business, along with AMD, they've also designed the chipset that runs the motherboard that sits inside of your computer. There are two control chips on that motherboard. One's called Southbridge and one's called Northbridge. The one we really care about is called Southbridge because it controls on motherboard audio, USB, and all other kinds of I/O. The only thing that's other thing that's really critical here is we're talking about multiple buses here. And what's a bus? A bus is something that moves data from one place to another. Does that sound familiar? That's important in streaming, right? It turns out that's important in everything in a computer, because all a computer does is two things. It moves stuff around in memory, and it does calculations on it. That's all a computer does. And so a bus is really important. The last bullet's kind of important from the standpoint that we get some very interesting high-performance audio on the motherboard as a result of the fact that we have DMA capability. And what that means is that we do not have to use the CPU to move data from one place to another. It can start it, but then the transfer happens without the CPU paying attention.
Can you read the bottom bullets, because people's heads are in the way of the people in the back?
Okay, so the second to last bullet says PCs have multiple buses, and a bus is something that moves data from one place to another. So that's the tie into streaming. Last bullet says the PCI bus has DMA, direct memory access, capability, and that allows streaming to happen independent of the CPU. The CPU says move it, and then it doesn't actually have to physically move the data itself, it just moves itself. So the bus itself has a little bit of smarts. We're actually in a process of evolution right now. The audio that's on your motherboard of your Windows PCs now is AC97. I haven't looked at one of the new Intel Macs, but they're very likely to have either AC97 or the next generation, which is what we call HD audio. At the level that we're talking about at the motherboard, it doesn't matter if you're running a Mac OS 10 anymore. I mean, if you've got an Intel Mac, you're running this kind of audio hardware. So on the Southbridge chip, it will have a little controller on it. And all that controller really does is allow you to address it, say, and I'm about to stream audio to you, and then it tells you, get ready, and then you start sending it data. And then all that does is that once it gets onto the bus, then it drops it onto the codec, and then you're either putting it on the speaker or receiving audio samples from the microphone. So at this level, at the most basic hardware level, it is definitely heading, and it's all the same, no matter which of the three major operating systems you're using. I think this is pretty apparent to everybody. The fact that you can buy as powerful a computer as you can buy right now for $400 or $500 or $1,000 means that we've completely commoditized an incredible amount of computing horsepower. This is good and bad. The good part of it is that you get a lot of computing power for cheap. The bad part of it is almost all audio in PCs right now sits on the motherboard. And since this is a commodity business, I'll give you a guess how much they spend on the DAC and the amplifier and the other stuff.
3 cents.
We're talking pennies here. That's exactly right. We're talking pennies per motherboard. Now, the good news is those pennies are very well spent. What you get out of it is not crappy. It's not wonderful, but it's not crappy either. But it is all commodity. I'm sorry, what?
Oh, I was just saying, relative to what you can get for a few pennies.
Yeah, and relative to what you can get for $100, too. So, which is the next up price point, what you get. Now, the saving grace on that is because nobody in this room cares about motherboard audio, right, is the plug-in peripherals. So now we're talking USB and 1394 FireWire. Oops, I think... I dropped a slide. Okay, so the next slide was supposed to be about USB audio. I managed to lose a slide. So that's that ubiquitous plug-in you have. The interesting thing about USB audio is that the current USB audio spec is based on 1.1. What that means is 2496 stereo is the highest rate audio you can get through a USB audio driver that's compliant with the current spec. Any USB audio interface that you have right now that plugs in and does more channels than that or higher sampling rates than that actually has a custom driver that uses USB 2.0 but is not compliant with the spec. So if that interface works for you, that's good. But when the USB 2.0 audio spec comes out, it probably will not be compliant with that. So that was the important part of that slide. FireWire Audio is ubiquitous on the Mac. There is no class driver or universal driver for 1394 FireWire on Windows. We hope that's going to change in the near future, but it's not true now. Any 1394 FireWire interface that you hook up into your PC has a proprietary driver that you install from the manufacturer. The numbers that we've been looking at on FireWire is it's losing big to USB right now. Lots and lots and lots of uptake on USB audio penetration.
Why? Because USB is so much slower. Less expensive, a wider market appeal, the guitarist. You only need a couple channels in and out.
Yeah, a lot of it has to do with...
For sure, but and also lower latency. But USB is kind of like that $99, $49 interface to buy a GC and pick up a guitar and start making music, from a market perspective.
Is USB 2.0 going to be multi-channel?
Yes, and that's solely a function of the USB 2.0 specification, quote-unquote high speed, just is faster and higher bandwidth, so it just carries more data. But it's one of those standard things. Microsoft is the USB audio consortium, the USB consortium is separate from industry. From any particular company and industry, and so that just the wheels of time that takes is lengthy. So we've actually been participating in the definition of the USB 2.0 audio standard for a while, and it's taking a long time. Question?
I don't know if this is the time to ask this or not. In a situation like with Pro Tools running out to a piece of dedicated hardware, are the protocols then, is what you're talking about here applicable to that as far as the data streaming? I know data is streamed, but does Pro Tools have its own way of doing that so that it can move as many pieces of streams of data as it wants to?
So Pro Tools, so I don't actually have a slide on this specifically, so let me just cover this for a couple seconds right here. Really what you're asking me is, how do they do low latency audio? Okay,
right.
We all know how to do long latency audio. You talk to certain APIs, you create a big buffer and you stuff it full of data, and then you let it play out. Okay, so that's how you do easy, long latency audio. The hard stuff is doing small buffers frequently or low latency. And so on the PC, there's basically three ways to do that. Our quote-unquote our way, sanctioned way, Microsoft way, is called DirectKS, Direct Kernel Streaming. That's basically how Cakewalk works. The second way to do that is Ozio. I think everybody's familiar with that. The third way to do it is to write your own proprietary API and driver set combination. That's what Digi does. So that, they've chosen to do that. And they've even done that down to the level of their low-end M-Audio stuff running on Pro Tools LE, for example. So that's a custom USB driver talking to a custom streaming protocol for low latency. And we've been talking to them lately, and based on the stuff that we're doing in Vista, they will probably no longer have to do that third thing. So it'll be more like, they can talk to something that's low latency like they do at Core Audio on the Mac.
And ASIO means ASO?
ASIO.
Audio signal input output.
Is that really what it stands for?
Yeah.
I'd forgotten one.
Correct?
Audio streaming input.
Streaming, thank you. The Steinberg.
So it was invented by Steinberg in 1995 to fill a gap in low latency audio. And actually, both platforms at that time, neither of them actually did that. So ASIO was written for the Mac and Windows. So they wrote most of of that interface, what we call user mode, with a little bit of kernel mode sitting down. But Okay, so did I begin to answer your question? Okay, thank you.
When you say low latency, what kind of number are you talking about?
That's a good question. The flip answer to your question is as low as you can get away with. And actually, there's a lot of truth to that, which is it depends. It depends on a lot of things. The kinds of things it depends on is the quality of the hardware that's on the other end of that driver interface. It depends on the quality of the computer that it's running in. It depends on the quality of the chipset that runs the motherboard and the version of the firmware that runs that. So there's a lot of variability. So there is no one answer on how low can you go. So that's why if you look at the manuals on these interfaces, the Pro Audio software, it says, oh, try 128. If that doesn't work, try 256. If that doesn't work, try 512. Well, why is that? Because the number of factors that can influence whether or not you can actually achieve reliable streaming at a certain at a buffer size of a certain number of frames, and I'll explain what a frame is in a second, varies on a lot of different factors. Generally speaking, I don't even know what to call it. The research that I've seen, that I've read, one of them is they hooked up, let's see if I remember how this paper worked, they basically were measuring for different kinds of instrumentalists how long a latency they could tolerate between when they actually hit a key or strummed a string and when they actually heard it and where it affected their playing. And who knows what that number was? Who can guess what that number is?
Was it 4.5 milliseconds?
That's actually too low. Yeah.
About
20. It actually turned out to be between 8 and 10. The person I talked to who ran some of this research said the reason why that was is that when you get the impulse, the nerve impulse in your finger, for example, every time it hits a nerve ending, it's like a switch in a network, and there's delay there. And it took 8 milliseconds for the feeling in your finger to hit your brain, and so they had 8 milliseconds for the sound to get to your ear and be processed. Does that sound plausible to you?
Your brain adjusts. It hears the latency, whatever it is.
You know, that turns out that that's true to a certain amount. If you try to, like, play a guitar at 30 milliseconds latency, yeah, it will drive you nuts.
Well, there's old tests done just with speech that show if you get up around 70 or 80 milliseconds, you can cause people to just go completely aphasic. Now, you can learn, some people can learn to talk past it, but talking into, especially around a quarter of a second, is disastrous. What?
They've got a test on the science center, they feed it back to you.
Yeah. The delay just drives you completely nutty.
Sounds like
there may be some conditioning involved. I think your sound moves about a quarter of a millisecond.
Yes.
Right.
I had a huge
Right. Go ahead.
Oh, I had a huge latency problem. When I plugged my MIDI keyboard into my laptop, and it took so long for it to process, I actually had to play the song slower to actually make it sound like anything.
So here's a tip. One of the most invasive things on a laptop is the power management system. Mm-hmm. And I'm not an expert on this level of tuning, but I've heard things about turning various parts of the power management off in Windows or the Mac. And the other thing is, if you can run your laptop without the battery in it, which some laptops you can do, the circuitry that actually will go and sense how much power is in the battery takes a bunch of CPU cycles. So if you can run your laptop without a battery in it, you know, just plugged into the wall, that'll help a lot. Now, if you're doing field recording and you don't have power source, then that doesn't help you, right? But
Your power cable is duct taped to your box. Otherwise, pick it up.
Yep, good point.
You also got to remember that MIDI has pretty high latency.
In general.
It can only send so many notes at a single time. So if you play a big block chord, sometimes you can actually hear it play note, 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 if you press them all at the same time.
Yep.
So it's another other factors. Generally, MIDI is not the best. It's still protocol.
Yeah, and so that is actually something that we hope to be working on in the future. There's the MIDI consortium is working on stuff like that, and we're working with them. So we would like to make some improvements on that end, but we're actually not going to talk about MIDI tonight. If, you know, in the next year's worth of talk, we want to talk about MIDI on the PC, we can try to get a talk put together on that, but that's out of scope for this talk.
Another thing you consider when you're talking about delay is most instruments take some number of samples of their fundamental frequency to actually get going. It's, you know, you're talking basic pitch is up to about a kilohertz or so, so you're talking 5 to 10 to 20 milliseconds just for the instrument to get going. On the other hand, at some point,
startup latency.
Startup, yeah. Built into an acoustic instrument.
Right. Okay, really quickly on HD audio. This is the next generation. I'm sorry. Was there one more question in the back? So I will address your question one way and tell you to wait until the end, because actually I talked about that at the end. One thing I want to say, and I think this might be on the last slide, isochronous does not mean real time, okay? Isochronous means get it there on time, which is different than real time. Mm-hmm. So we often talk about real time in audio, but what real time means is get it there on time. And that's directly related to buffer size. Buffer size is directly related to latency. So I know I sound like a broken record, but that's really what it means. So the answer to your question is yes. I just wanted to point out that I wouldn't call it real time. And the people who do computer science work in real-time OS would agree that what we're talking about is not real time. Really quickly in HD audio, your next generation Mac, Linux, PC, Windows, whatever, motherboards, they all will have this thing we call HD audio. This is part of this universal audio architecture that Microsoft and Intel have put together. And since Intel's going to apparently run all the motherboards of all the personal computers in the world from now on, this is basically the audio that's on the motherboard. Do you care? You think, well, I don't care about motherboard audio. But we're talking about 8-channel, 32-bit, 192 kilohertz on the motherboard. Actually,
with what kind of analog support?
Yeah. Well, JJ notwithstanding, we are trying very hard to improve the quality of some of the systems here.
Oh, yes.
So JJ is expending huge amounts of effort on what we call testing, so that if you put the premium logo on one of a Microsoft system, that it has minimal audio fidelity standards. Now, why do you care about this? You care about this if you care about the penetration of this kind of musical instrument usage, either from an educational standpoint, a personal standpoint, or a commercial standpoint, because your 16-year-old son or daughter or next-door neighbor or student actually doesn't want to spend $100 or $200 on that nice plug-in interface so that they can play their MIDI guitar. They just don't want to do that. And we've done a lot of research on this end of the market that says that they want to do that. They have this PC. They go, why doesn't that PC do that? And so this is one of the ways that we're actually trying to make motherboard audio better. So it doesn't matter to you, but it does matter to you in a tangential and maybe significantly indirect way. So that's the deal on that. Okay, way back when, we were playing a CD. Okay, so we got reasonable fidelity. I didn't buy a CD player until 1994, something like that. You know, I had a Thorns turntable and 1,200 LPs, and, you know,
yeah.
Sounded really good. I had a CD player, and it sounded like crap. But it turns out that the DACs in the beginning kind of pretty much sucked. And as the state of the art in onboard and outboard DACs improved, and we got little boxes that helped with the jitter problem on outboard DACs, got really, really good, CDs started sounding pretty good. So it turned out that WAV files at 16-bit 44.1 were pretty good. What's the bad news? Stairway to Heaven, 11 minutes, 9 seconds long. Using the calculation we talked about before, 118 megabytes at 44.116 bit. That's, even on today's capacious hard drives, really, really, really big. A 5 gigabyte portable media player holds less than 100 5-minute songs at 16-bit 44.1. So the solution there is compression. So that's what we're going to talk about next. Oh, well, I'll talk about the last bullet at the end. So these are the compressed formats, MP3, WMA, AAC. And I'd like to point this out. I actually didn't know this until a couple of days ago. So this AAC thing that iTunes uses that everybody thinks Apple invented, Apple did not invent AAC. You know who invented AAC? Dolby? This guy right here.
Yay. Right, I invented my largest competitor.
Okay, so all of you who have iPods, thank you. So basically, what has come about, and this is really important in terms of internet streaming, is that you have a WAV file source, or you have music that's recorded in PCM. You cannot possibly reliably stream that over the internet to a large number of people. So even if saving space on your own hard disk was not a reason to introduce compression, just the fact that we wanted to stream music content, radio stations, talk shows, whatever, over the internet, necessitated the fact that we would take a big representation of the audio data, compress it to something that's much smaller, and then decompress it at the other end. There's a lot of requirements that this puts on the people who design these codecs, which stands for compression decompression. The primary one of which is when you decode it, it must be done quickly. Okay. Now we say it must be done real time, but it's actually not true. It just must be done on time. And especially when you're dealing with internet radio streams or satellite radio. Who knows what the bit rate of satellite radio is? So they won't tell. They won't tell what it is, but I'm pretty sure that it's somewhere between 32 and 48 kilohertz bit rate.
28 and 32, but you didn't hear that from me.
So let's hear from Elliot. What
do you say? I'm only guessing. I mean, I've talked to the people at XM a lot, and I've tried to pry this information out of it, and I've never successfully done so.
Is that two channels encoded at that rate?
Yeah. Yeah, stereo.
I believe at one time XM was maybe doing 64, and I think they, because of the competition, as it were, whatever their motives, I think then they dumped it down to less, anyway.
There was some deal with satellite capacity and stuff like that, and also they went from layer 3 to AAC.
Right.
That's not true. Sirius is using Ubiquiti and XM is using Neural Audio.
But
and
Ubiquiti?
Very bit rate depending on channel.
Well, yeah, but the thing about Ubiquiti at this point is Ubiquiti has dropped their codec work and they're using AACHE.
Well, the Sirius name is still using the original proprietary Ubiquiti design.
We can talk about that offline.
Okay, so. So what does bitrate mean? You get an AAC file off of iTunes and it says 128. What does that mean? So what that means is that it's 128,000 bits per second of compressed data. Sorry, the per second on that one is superfluous. But what that means is that how much data will be in there compressed. And then that will decompress to how much data? Well, the thing about it is we don't know. For a unit of compressed data, you cannot predict how big the output data will be until you decompress it. So what they will do is they will advertise my output rate when I decompress will be 16-bit 44.1, typically for music files. So that's what it means, is that's how big the compressed data is. This slide's mistitled. There's no math on this slide. Okay, sorry.
You mean no more math?
Yeah, that would be good. No more math. So the previous calculation or the previous description is for constant bit rate. We also have this thing called VBR, variable bit rate codecs. So what they do is they analyze the data and they go, oh, well, I need a lot of space for that content. Or they'll analyze the data and go, I only need this much space. And we'll call that VBR codecs. Does AAC have VBR?
AAC has no concept of bitrate in the bitstream. It can be anything, either one or both.
So it's inherently VBR.
Well, it's if you just run at threshold, it's totally VBR. You can run it at threshold. You can run it with a constant maximum rate, and it can drop below that. You can run it at constant rate. You can run it at network demand rate.
I see. Okay. Okay, so here's where I define codec, compress and decompress. And the fact that you must decode in real time. See, even I say real time, but I actually meant on time. Last thing I want to say about compression is there are two different kinds. There's lossy, and this is what we call psychoacoustic coding, of which there's very many different kinds of techniques. And this is where we lean on JJ to give us his talk sometime in the future about psychoacoustic coding. He gives a very good talk about this.
3 hours long, and bring your coffee.
We should try to get maybe the slight Reader's Digest condensed version of it.
That's the 3-hour version. The version I give to university professors is the whole day.
Okay, so if you are interested in this topic, there's lots of information on that on the web. There's a lot of literature and study about what we call artifacts, which is when you compress and then decompress it, and the signal's imperfect. What do those imperfections sound like? We were actually thinking of doing a test in here, but we ultimately decided that it wasn't going to serve much purpose. So one of the things you can do is take some commercial products, pull the WAV file off of a CD onto a WAV file onto your computer of choice, and then rip that or download the equivalent version in 20-bit and get into a good, quiet listening environment. Put a pair of headphones on and do your own A-B tests on that.
Or you could just do a difference and listen to the noise only.
Except that isn't at all meaningful.
Well, true.
The problem with doing that is that the psychoacoustic model hides stuff under the signal. So when you take away the signal...
Right.
The one thing it's good for is finding out if something just went completely, which occasionally you find out, but in general it's not a very useful concept. If you add in some of that to the original, a bit at a time, that's a good way to train. Mm-hmm. But you listen to the difference by itself doesn't actually help you very much.
It actually sounds like the original material in a way.
Well, if it sounds like the original material, your coder isn't working right. If it sounds like a truly grossly corrupted version of the original material, then it's working right.
Like it in that you can recognize it. It's not
you'd be surprised.
Okay, so I'm going to call time out here.
There's
a 3-hour talk that talks about nothing but that. And let's not try to have that talk at whatever time it is right now.
No, definitely not.
The thing I really like about this is the people who really get into this find the songs that drive coders crazy. And so you'll hear them talking about that Cowboy Junkie song or that Suzanne Vega Tom Steiner song, which they've known through testing drove some aspect of their coder completely bonkers. And so it's really interesting what songs they end up turning out that go through one of these compressor decompressors and then ends up sounding really bad. Or usually just one certain part of it will end up sounding really bad, and then they concentrate on that. And then these songs kind of become famous in these small circles of people because they just drive them crazy. They listen to that and they go, that sounds terrible. The other kind of compression is straight data compression. Think zip files. This, if done properly, is perfect. I mean, you're going to get the same WAV file PCM data out that you put into it. And the algorithms that are used that are more or less guaranteed to be on time do a reasonable amount of compression on that. So what happens when you rip a CD? So a CD ripping software does the exact same thing that... the
the software does when it plays it, reads the CD to play it, is it spins the disk up, and then it reads the PCM data, it runs the compressed side of the codec, which does basically analyze and compress, and then outputs a compressed buffer, and then eventually writes a file. The one interesting thing that's not on this slide is there's a big difference between spinning a CD for playback and spinning a CD for ripping. So if you notice, if you rip a CD, it'll spin the disk up to its close to its maximum spin rate. And if it's doing it for playback, it usually will run it at 1 or 2x. Why is that? I mean, why do they run it at such different speeds? There's really two reasons for that. The first reason is when you spin a CD up for 48x, it just makes a whole lot of noise. And when you're listening to music, you don't want your drive making a whole lot of noise. So that's really the primary reason. The second reason is if they spin the CD up to 48 times or whatever it is, they're going to buffer up way, way, way more data than they need for the small buffer that they need for playback. So it turns out it's actually not necessary for them to spin the disk up that fine. And then the third thing is if it's on a laptop, when they spin the CD up that fast, it eats a lot of battery power. So that's why the CD thing is done. And I guess they assume that your laptop's going to be plugged in when you rip a CD, which may or may not be true. Dan?
Why is it called ripping?
I don't know. Does anybody know the answer to that question?
I think it's from raster image processing, which is a term that they used originally for printing. Or when you take a file and convert it into something that your computer can read.
I always thought it's because you're ripping off.
Yeah. Well, I think the term became popular because of that, but actually your explanation actually seems completely plausible. So it's interesting. I never knew.
Wasn't originally prepared in a computer format where there was guaranteed reliability of reading every bit in the data. So you're taking it out of its normal output chain of the CD-ROM drive being hooked directly to your sound card and inputting it as data to be processed by the CPU. And that's why RIP is used rather than read.
That's interesting. The other piece of trivia is that your CD drive is no longer hooked up directly to your sound card, because guess what? There is no sound card in your machine, number one. And number two, that connector costs money. And so they eliminate it. No computer manufacturer hooks those two things up together anymore, solely because of cost. And so that little checkbox that says, do you want to run your CD analog in your Windows control panel? I removed that like a year ago. It's no longer in the OS because there really is no such hardware anymore. Okay, this is where I stand up here with a big target put on me. This is close to the second to the last topic. So this is encryption. So this is usually applied in addition to compression. So you have a compressed encrypted file. What's that good for? People call this DRM. The way this works, without going into an extremely long talk about DRM, and I'm not a DRM expert, so I'm not the person who's qualified to give that talk, is when you sign up for iTunes or Napster or any other kind of DRM type system, they will assign you a unique key, and I mean that key in the encryption sense. And that content will be compressed using the normal means, and then it will be scrambled or encrypted based on that key. And only you on that one computer, or a computer to which that key is maybe allowed to be transferred, can decrypt that thing. And so you go through this two-stage process of decrypt and then decompress. And so that's basically what happens on that. I'm pretty sure that this is here to stay. This is not going anywhere. I think a lot of people are fairly unhappy about that. But I see no trend in the future that says that's not going to diminish.
Any idea when and if FairPlay and Windows DRM will break down the barrier between them?
Like, when will they interoperate?
Yeah.
That's a really complicated legal and business question.
It really hurts our business.
I completely agree with that. My
I'm of two minds on this. I'll be completely transparent with you, is that as a user, I want that interoperation. As somebody who, you know, competes with Apple in digital media things, it's like it's helpful to us as it is helpful to them to be able to promote your platform and content management so that you can make deals with labels. So I wish it were not so. After I balance my personal interests and the business interests, I wish it were not so.
It's not consumer-centered at all. It's more business-centered.
You know, I think that users have a lot more power than they think. I mean, you vote with your wallets. And some of the governments in Europe are pretty mad at Apple right now about the closed loop of iTunes, Fair Play, and the iPod, and want to open that up. And of course, we hope that happens too. But
doesn't iTunes work on a PC?
It does work on a PC, but it's not Windows Media DRM.
It's proprietary.
And so that DRM content will only play on one player in the world. That's an iPod. As opposed to Windows Media, we license that DRM technology to anybody who wants to sign up for it and make whatever kind of deal, the details of which I have no idea what they are, with Microsoft.
So if you buy music from iTunes, it only plays on your PC or on your iPod, but
correct.
Nobody else can write an app.
Right.
Like you guys.
Correct.
I'm able to take music from my iTunes, put it into my Windows Media Player, and put it onto my personal little thumb drive MP3 player.
So, and you decrypted it where in that chain? Because you definitely did.
You can burn it from iTunes onto a CD, which then is...
Right, okay, so that's the one, definitely known way.
From the internet on iTunes, it'll show up on my iTunes, I'll move it over to my Windows Media Player, and it shows up there.
Is it from the iTunes store that you purchased, or is it from just someplace?
It'll show up there, it'll play there, and I can put it over.
So I actually don't know the question, but I know for sure you decrypted that. You being a general term, decrypted that somewhere along the line, because when it came down from iTunes, it was definitely encrypted.
Somewhere you have an interesting piece of software on that box.
Which is probably in violation of some license agreement somewhere. The main point I wanted to make about this slide... The main point I wanted to make about this slide was the whole concept of the combination of encryption and compression. I know there's a lot of issues, and we could get a long and interesting discussion about this, but...
DECSS is the term for the software that cracks DVD compression?
Yes. CSS is Content Scrambling System.
And
now,
DECSS.
The DECSS...
Oh, yeah, that's right. That's a...
CSS.
So we're not supposed to have that up there.
None of you know what that is, nor have ever used it, I'm sure.
Next slide.
So when I think about futures in audio, and I'll keep this short because it's speculative and it's late, is more about distribution than anything else. We have a really interesting project run in Microsoft Research by a gentleman named Tom Blank, which we call IP Speakers. And basically, these are IP in the networking sense, TCP/IP, addressable speakers that you can put throughout a home or business. And the interesting thing about this research project, which we're currently trying to productize, is that not only can you send basically an internet radio stream, quote-unquote, to these individual speakers, you can synchronize them. Now, how do you do that? Because you know for sure that over a TCP/IP network, you're never going to get packets to all the speakers in a house at the same time to play out. And you know if they're off by even a little bit, they're going to drive you totally crazy. Well, what they do is on those internet, on those IP packets, they will distribute a clock to those things so they know when those samples are supposed to play, and they do the same kind of keyframe thing that they do in video with the audio. So it's pretty interesting development. And we've got a couple rooms in our house that don't have synchronized audio, and we're going to love to have this.
But don't you still have the problem where the crystal clock inside each speaker is slightly different?
There's no crystal in there. The clock is distributed from the internet.
There's a crystal, but the crystal is pulled to the right frequency.
So, yeah, that's a good point, because I didn't get into this. I thought about putting a slide in on this, but basically there's a thing where you have two clocks,
and you want to make one relative to the other, we call that slaving. And so that's what will happen on that, is they will do what we call micro sample rate conversion.
So basically
there's going to be a micro SRC happening at the speaker.
It does some other interesting things too. It can, if you put a bunch of them in a room, they can figure out where they are and figure out which one's left and center and right, things like that.
It's very interesting work. What they've had to do to hack the driver level of the operating system has been kind of gruesome for them. Second trend, which I thought was interesting, is over-the-air music purchases and subscriptions. Who thinks in 5 years you will have an iPod and a phone that are separate? It does not make sense that those devices are separate. So how will you get your music? Well, you might dock it to your PC and get it, but more likely you're just going to suck it out over the air and get that. So I think that will be a really interesting, I hate to use this term, but convergence. Higher resolution audio and the thing. So the last three things are shameless plugs. So let me finish that really quick. So this is the diagram that was a lot of complexity that we really tried to simplify. This is the audio part of that XP component diagram. And this is Vista. We call it UMA. This is user mode audio. Really, really quickly, a whole bunch of the audio stack in Windows used to run in what we call kernel mode. That's what that's where device drivers live. And basically what we did is we took what we call Windows driver model drivers, WDM drivers, left that intact, so things like DirectKS and Osio still worked. That was really critical. And then we rebuilt completely the audio stack in Windows. The question in the back about, do we have real-time or low-latency APIs? Yes, we do. So in Vista, you will be able to do what we call pull mode audio at very low latencies. And that will work across every audio driver that runs on Windows and complies with WDM, which is basically all the audio drivers now.
Question. Did you just say pull mode?
Yes.
Okay. I'm not sure you heard correctly.
Yeah. Without going into a lot of detail, that's basically the only way you can make really low latency buffers like 120 and 256 frames work reliably.
Is it P-O-L-L or
P-U-L-L? P-U-L-L, pull versus push. Yeah. So there's basically two ways to stream audio. One is called push mode and one's called pull mode, and so it's push or pull. In the back?
The nature of my question was, are there going to be features in the operating system to control other applications interfering with audio when you're trying to do a low latency application?
Define what you mean by interfere.
Well, for example, needing to unplug the battery of the laptop to get the power management system to stop interfering with audio seems excessive. You know, are there going to be features to be able to control
certain
activity?
So I'd say at that level, in that way, I would say the answer is mostly no. And it's really a reflection of the constant struggle we have when we're working on an OS as big and complex as Windows, with respect to the fact that it's a general purpose operating system. It's allowed and does do many, 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 many different things. And so it's really a constant struggle between optimizing for a specific use, in this case Pro Audio, and doing it on a general purpose platform. So there are things like CPU scheduling, which you would want to do in a different way if you knew you were only running one application on one piece of audio hardware ever. But we actually really can't design an operating system for 500 million people and put those kind of constraints into it. Now, that being said, it is really true that we're working really, really hard with driver manufacturers so that they, when they write their drivers, they do them properly. Because most of the misbehaviors that will cause you problems in your audio system are the fault of driver programming. Now, it's not to say that there aren't improvements that we can't make at the very lowest levels of the operating system we have, and there are many of those in Vista, but most of the problems that you actually encounter when you use these are due to drivers misbehaving. And so one of the key initiatives we do in the Universal Audio Architecture, which actually includes 1394 USB and HD audio, is specify the way hardware should be built so that a single driver that we publish in the OS will work on that hardware, and that's what we call a class driver. This has two beneficial effects. One is that it's not necessary for manufacturers to write drivers. They can rely on us to write drivers. And I tell you, it's very hard to write drivers that are reliable and well-behaved. And the second thing is, if when you plug that thing in for the first time, what do you want it to do? You want it to work, right? Now, maybe it doesn't work as completely optimally as the manufacturer wanted it to work, and they need and you need their driver. But in the transition period from the time you first plug it in and want it to work at all, so like your ding comes out when your email arrives or whatever, or the first time you just want to like stream a song out of Pro Tools, and then you can go through and install their driver. And so one of the key things that we're doing in the Vista OS that they've really pretty much already accomplished on the Mac OS is this thing called class drivers, which is you run that one driver across a range of hardware that was written to a published standard. So, but I think in truth, the answer to your question is mostly no. It's really complex to control all of the variabilities in a general purpose OS. So unfortunately, what that means is that you have to select your hardware and your software carefully. You have to configure it correctly, and then you have to monitor what it does.
Or switch to dedicated hardware. I was going to say it's important to understand the difference for musicians who've been around maybe for 20 or 30 years and remember when computers couldn't do audio, you had to buy a specialized device that did audio. They got rid of the buffer completely, so there wasn't buffer-related latency. They had dedicated processors and dedicated memory that they could create the audio or play it back from the recording and go straight to the DAC without a buffer in between. So there's no latency there. And now everyone's switching to using their laptop or using their computer instead of what used to be dedicated musical instrument. Dedicated.
So I think that's a good point. I mean, I think that there is no question that, I mean, none of these types of computer applications are going to go away. But I think that there's always a happy medium between balancing things. You don't want to be all MIDI and all computer. I think that there's a role for dedicated hardware in the world. So I think it's a good point. Excuse me, a good point.
It seems like the issue, one of the issues here is prioritization. And it's maybe a similar issue to what network people deal with in trying to put real-time or on-time applications on a network. Like streaming video across a network or something, it's really distracting to watch if the packets have arrived late. And so when they talk about making the internet work better, they talk about prioritizing packets and stuff like that. And I don't know about this on my area, but it's maybe the same issue here.
It's actually a little bit different, and this is one of the ways that I find audio really interesting to work on and different than video. We stream packets generally using UDP. And the difference between TCP/IP and UDP is if the packet's too late, you drop it. Okay, if it's not going to get there just on time, just forget about it. It just doesn't matter because the frame of video that it's synchronized with, it's gone. Now, the other interesting thing about it is if you start losing video and you drop frames, people notice that less than when you drop audio samples. I mean, this has just been well proven. And so it's actually not the same because the reliability or the tolerances for starvation or missing data is much more stringent on audio. Your ear is much more sensitive than your eye on these sorts of things. If you have 24 frames per second and you drop a frame every once in a while, you're probably not going to notice because the nominal rate at which that those flipping bitmaps turn into fluid motion is actually well below 24 frames per second. And so the challenges are a lot different. And the network protocols are a little bit different, too, because the guarantee on TCP/IP is that we'll get there eventually. And as we've just found out, get there eventually is no good for us. It's got to be there, quote-unquote, on time. So
that's what I'm talking about. I mean, when we talk about how can we make the Internet a place where we can reliably transmit at least some of the packets, then they talk about maybe adding priority code to the packets.
Right.
I'm wondering if this same concept might be useful in an operating system, not just for audio, but for other applications. That has priority right now.
It is, and I'll give you one example to think. One of the new features in the Vista Audio Stack is just one background information. You may or may not have heard of this thing called threads. Threads are things that run code in computer programs. When your computer wakes up and it's got to do a bunch of different things, that like looks at all the threads in the system and all the programs and decides which is the highest priority thread that is ready to run. And in the Vista audio system, for the purpose of audio and video, but primarily audio in this audience, processing, you can register a thread, and it can be the highest priority thread in the system, except the system itself. And so, actually, we have done that with threads of execution in the Vista audio system.
That seems like a good idea.
Yeah. And we've actually used that to very good stead. We have this amazing demo, which I was trying to get ready for tonight, but didn't, where we... basically run this CPU stress allocation, and we basically can stress the machine to the point where the mouse does not even work on the machine, and we can still stream audio and video on Vista. And it's because of this thread prioritization work we've done.
That was the demonstration you showed at the Vista Summit,
yep.
Right? Yeah. That was very cool.
That would only work if you have one audio thread.
No, it works on multiple threads the way we've designed it. Actually, it works very well. Now, it's a finite resource, the CPU, right? So you can get to the point where you create enough of these high priority threads, and the system will be, you know, not very responsive.
Does that do something like kind of tweak or adjust the priority as according to the amount of data left in the buffer?
No, it basically adjusts that priority based on the CPU load of the system.
Maybe a foolish question, but is it possible to look at an architecture? It sounds to me like this thread prioritization is an automation of what I was thinking about, to design the architecture so that the system could be manually simplified to deal with just what it is we want to deal with. So you have this immensely complex OS that can do so many things, but you don't want so many things. You only want this one thing. So you sort of toss all that manually, and you limit yourself as an operator.
So it's an interesting thing about, and this is why I love working at a big company that has a lot of impact over a lot of users like Microsoft, is that technically speaking, there's no barriers to what you just described. We could slice and dice all kinds of parts of the operating system.
An automated version of this that operates virtually.
See, the interesting thing about this isn't technical. The interesting thing is about what business model does Microsoft have. And we're in the business of general purpose operating systems. And so it's just always a fine line between making the OS as good as it can be for a particular function and still sell to literally hundreds of millions of people. And so while it's technically possible to do what you say, it probably is not business model.
Wouldn't pay off.
Right.
So few users would take advantage of it.
Well, even now, if you're setting up a computer for audio work, you turn off automatic updates, you turn off all sorts of things. You go into the system file, and you turn off scads of things.
Unplug your network cable.
So that your computer's only doing what you're trying to do.
The good part of it is you can do that. The bad part of it requires some fairly special knowledge on how to do that. And there's the challenge. I think it's too hard to configure these pro audio workstations right now. It's too hard to do that.
I think it would be nice if you applied the MUNS method.
The what method?
The MUNS method. Yeah, right. You turn stuff off until the thing stops. Then you back up one step.
If you could take the knowledge, though, that you've collected on these things and do like a theme, say I want an audio-oriented theme or a video-oriented theme, and you guys already know to go through the registry and go through places, shut down certain things.
That's actually a really good idea.
You brought this up and said, look, I've got preconceived configurations that, based on the knowledge that's already here and on campus, plus your users feeding it into you, you could then preset the machine so you answer their questions without them having to dig into the registry and possibly blow it off and then discover, whoops, my machine doesn't work anymore.
Yeah, the other interesting thing about our business model is we don't sell PCs. Our OEMs do. And so, you know, in the classic relationship we've had with them, you know, it's been up to them to build machines that can be configured for specific purposes. But, I mean, the whole idea about how themes that are good for a general class of usage, and we would like more we would like more low-latency, music-oriented usage of Windows. I mean, that's really clear. And so I think that that helps that. There's a question over here.
I was just wondering if Microsoft
exactly.
Various companies or just organizations, be video production, audio production, steel manufacturing that is really narrowing down the operating system for those specific industries, or that's...
Well, I wouldn't say we're narrowing down the operating system, but yes, we have a team that are working with those things, and Eric Schmidt's the guy you want to work for, and want to talk to, and he's going to work for Eric Schmidt, so myself and others in the room can help you with that. Go ahead.
I heard about some programming taking out other programs. In particular, somebody loaded a Sony CD, and the Sony software took out Nero, so that you couldn't.
Yeah, that's a really interesting thing. I don't think we have time to cover that tonight. But yeah, Sony did a really interesting thing. Interesting. So. I can stand up here and say with a pretty straight face that was a, what's the adjective I want to use? An inappropriate application of DRM.
Well put.
There's this thing where you can hook the operating system at a very low level and do things to it that it wasn't meant to do. It's called a rootkit. And basically the Sony, about 50 or 60 Sony discs, some from some big name artists, and in fact,
there's some other ones that are much older than that too. The Try, yeah, don't run autoplay.
I thought I had one of those discs in my bag, but I can't find it right now. So they installed a rootkit, and then they played with the CD-ROM file system driver, and they hooked it, and they intercepted it. And then they went through great pains, which only rootkits are really capable of doing, of hiding itself. And then they made it impossible to uninstall, which got them basically sued. And now they have, as part of that settlement, agreed to not put that kind of system in place for a certain amount of time and to tell users what kind of DRM they're doing, and basically, going way too far in DRM really cost them a lot. So I think they learned their lesson. And I think that there is an acceptable amount of fair rights enforcement that people can get away with. And to do anything more than that is really not a good idea.
The thing was, anybody who knew about that installed on your computer, any hacker could use that.
Absolutely. Yeah, it was a big security problem waiting to happen. But, I mean, we're not talking about naive users. The person who first discovered this is named Mark Rusinovich, and he's done a lot of work with Windows internals. You know how he found this out? He got himself infected with one of those CDs. So, and I would characterize him as a very sophisticated user. So, let me see what else is on these slides. We're basically done here, but... Oh, this was a plug for JJ's team. So,
last streaming block diagram. So, this is the Vista Audio Stack. WSAPI is Windows Audio Session API. That's the new audio API in Vista. And this is an audio engine. This is a diagram I threw together this morning. Sorry, it's so crude looking. Basically, what an audio engine does is it takes one or more streams, it processes them in the signal processing sense. Then it mixes it together and it drops it down on the audio hardware. If you wanted to do any specialized digital signal processing in the operating system in XPM before, what you had to do was write a device driver. We found through long and painful experience that device drivers are not simple to write. If you screw it up, you blue screen your machine. So what we've done is we made sure that there was a place in user mode where you couldn't take down the whole machine to write signal processing extension. And many people in this room work at Microsoft, work in this
Core Media Processing Technology Team. Is that what CMPT stands for? Is that right?
This week.
Okay. Did they write per stream and global signal processing effects? And so now there's a really convenient and well-documented place to hook up signal processing extensions in the Windows operating system. Did you want to say anything else about the work that you guys have done?
No, I don't. I mean, if you have an opportunity to try Beta 2 with an inbox driver, just go to the effects tab and try this stuff there. It almost works at this point.
There's interesting stuff in there. There's RIM correction, bass management, headphone virtualization. Well, I mean, there's some pretty interesting things there.
Well, things to look at are, there's something called loudness equalization. If you remember the loudness talk I did 3 months ago, it's basically the talk came out of the simplified version of what that does, so you can give that a try. And the other thing that might be real, well, two interesting things that might, other things that might be interesting would be the headphone virtualization and the room correction. A room correction is a bit pain in the neck to use. You have to pull out a mic and hold it over your head and so on, but might give those a look. And if you break them, push a little button that says it broke.
Otherwise known as file above.
Sounds like a small price to pay, though, for what it gives you.
Okay, the summary is PC audio is isochronous. You've heard me say it over and over and over, and now get the data there on time. Lots of activity. In the recent years, there's been compression and encryption. iTunes would not have happened without either of those, without both of those, excuse me. And the feature is all about extending these technologies to new distribution scenarios. So I hope you found out some of what you came here just to hear about tonight, and thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you.
Thank you all for coming. This is our last meeting for the academic year. We'll start again in September. Watch the website. And if you would please take all the garbage that you have and put it in the garbage can.
Yeah,
I'm going to start with that.
Elliot, can you put those up on the share?
Keep in mind when you do it.
Well, I'm going to put them on the AES Pacific Northwest website.
Oh, okay,
right?
Okay.
Yeah.
He's going to put them up on the AES website. A couple of the guys in our group were asking for
Yeah, I'd like to have it to help rate the rate up. But if it's going on the website.
The lowest one you can get away with.
You put it on the website. Oh, sorry, not
yeah,
you.
That's always the answer.
Unfortunately.
Yeah, I think 512 frames works fine. Definitely if you can run 256, that's really good. Rarely do I see people reliably get away with 128. So you're really always pretty much looking at 256 or 512 frames.
I think that the others do. I was wondering if I could have your slide deck.
It's going to be posted on the Pacific Northwest section in the next couple of days.
Thank you.
Have you seen this yet?
No, I'm about to pitch.
Wait a second. That's the door prize I wanted. Oh, hell yeah.
Are you familiar with Weed?
I'm not.
Music distribution system using Windows Media Files. You
very
may know
good.
About Windows Media Files. I'll have to pitch it every day.
So Eric Schmidt knows about you, right?
I would assume so, but I don't know about him yet. But
okay.
What Weed is it's you can play a file three times before being asked to pay for it. The fourth time it says you seem to like this, time to buy it, or don't play it again. If you choose to buy it, 50% goes to the artist. And
I have heard about this.
This
yeah.
is it, yeah. And there's the 20, 10, and 5% back once. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. So you don't care about me. Who you care about is Eric Schmidt. But get in contact with me, and I'll get you in contact with him.
I'd love to give you a directory of Weed products.
Okay, great.
So you can add, actually, I'm a mastering engineer.
Great.
So that's a bunch of stuff I've mastered and brought into Weed. There's my mastering card.
Okay.
So there you go. Thank you for your question.
Do you mind if I grab a mastering card from you as well?
Oh, certainly, absolutely.
So explain to me the
Weed. Okay, sure. You can play it three times. Okay. Fourth time, you have to buy it or you don't play it again.
Okay.
If you buy it, you can bring it to a CD or whatever.
Okay.
And when you buy it, 50% goes to the artist.
Okay.
And your user ID is stamped into the file.
How many artists are involved at this point?
There's about 125,000 file signers.
Okay.
And you go through it. And what I'd recommend is just the directory, the USB weed directory.
Mm-hmm.
Right, and just drop that on your desktop. And you'll be all good. And it's a real fast flash key, so it'll be about a minute.
So, as an artist or a producer, how do you get songs on?
You go through independent content providers, and what they do is they get a rights holder agreement signed with you, and it gets put into Windows Media Files,
okay.
And then it's bounced off of our weed servers to get encrypted,
okay.
Then it goes back to you. And that's because it hadn't been sold yet,
okay.
The 2010 file didn't get.